Welcome to Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Meet marine geophysicist Maya Tolstoy. She specializes in seafloor earthquakes and volcanoes and has participated in 31 ocean-going expeditions, leading or co-leading more than half of them. In 2005, Maya was part of director James Cameron's expedition to film the 3D IMAX documentary Aliens of the Deep. 4 years later, Maya was one of 47 finalists out of more than 3,500 applicants for NASA's astronaut selection. Dr. Tolstoy's authored 51 peer-reviewed publications. Her 2008 Nature paper was featured in the National Science Foundation's annual report to Congress. She's also been on the receiving end of $16 million in federal research grants. An associate professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Studies at Columbia, Maya spent 5 years as the co-chair of the university's Commission on the Status of Women. And it goes without saying that as a female working in the physical sciences, she's all too familiar with the issues facing professional women who work in male-dominated fields. Maya, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, let's go this way. How did you, volcanoes and seafloor earthquakes, get together?
Well, I was always fascinated with earthquakes and volcanoes ever since I can remember as a small child. Just sort of the power of them, the power of the earth to break apart
and explode.
Move chunks and explode, mountaintops to blow off. Mount St. Helens erupted when I was a child, and I was just completely in awe of that. And my father was a scientist, and he had a background in geology and geophysics also, so I learned about it as well as a child. So I was always fascinated, and then as a undergraduate, I studied geophysics, but I wasn't sure if I was going to go on in science. And then I went to the University of Edinburgh, and they required us to get work experience between our third and fourth year. And most people in the geophysics program went down to London and worked for the oil companies. But I was actually born in America, and I always wanted to go back to America, so I decided to try and find a job in the U.S. So I wrote to every imaginable geology, geophysics address I could find, from mining companies to oil companies.
Were there a lot of them?
I just went to the library and looked up things in the back. None of them responded. But but eventually, actually through a man called Peter Rona from Rutgers, a very well-known scientist who unfortunately passed away earlier this year, he connected me with a program at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And they were just starting a summer internship program, and it was their first year of doing this, and they hired three undergraduates for the summer, one in biology, one in chemistry, and one in geophysics. So I went over to Scripps for—
Which is in California,
which
right?
Which is in California, yeah. It's part of University of California, San Diego. And there I was set to work building timers for bombs to go off on the seafloor. So we basically were trying to make small explosions on the deep seafloor to measure their arrivals using seismometers that we would put on the seafloor. And so we went up to the local drugstore, bought these little Casio watches, broke them apart, wired the timers up to circuit boards, then took them to sea and attached them to boxes of explosives. So this was quite a formative experience for me, but mostly it was the experience actually at sea for 10 days. So we went out—
What sea?
In the Pacific Ocean. So okay. We went out of San Diego, and we went up off the coast of Monterey, and we deployed some seismometers, and it was part of a bigger experiment. There were other ships there, and I was just totally—
Smitten?
Smitten. With going to sea.
Seismology.
And with being out on the ocean, being out on a ship, working as part of a small team together in this environment. And at that time, we didn't have phones or email out at sea either. And it was just so beautiful out there, the ocean and the stars at night. And I completely fell in love with it. So I sort of ended up combining my fascination with earthquakes and volcanoes with this love of going to sea to study seafloor earthquakes and volcanoes.
So it was kind of happenstance.
And I ended up having a couple of offers, but this person was actually a friend of my father's who I trusted very much for the, to, you know, as the reference to go there to
And you spent the entire summer.
And I spent the entire summer there. And, you know, to go from Scotland, where it was rainy and cold, even in the summer, to San Diego for 3 months was quite a, it made quite an impression.
I was going to say there were some bonuses
and
here.
So I applied for grad school at Scripps.
At California. I'm staying.
And that's where I went, yeah.
Go back 1 second. You were born in the States, but then your family moved to Scotland?
Yes.
Are your parents Scottish?
No.
They moved to Scotland because of your dad's work?
Initially, we moved to England. My dad had a professorship at Leeds University, but then we ended up living in Scotland. He decided to write books, and so we wanted to live in the middle of nowhere in Scotland. My parents wanted my sister and I to go to this particular school that was in southern Scotland that was a kind of countercultural school based on the free school system where there are no rules. But
parents kind of funky people, huh?
But they were also quite academic people. So they were sort of idealistic, but also quite academic. And after a year, they realized we weren't actually learning anything at this school. So they took us out and put us in the regular school system. But they liked where we were living. And my dad then, we ended up going back to California for a year when I was 11. He had a one-year position at the Naval Postgraduate School. And from that position, he then sort of renewed his contacts in the U.S. funding system. And so he was funded by actually the U.S. Navy to do research in Scotland. So he was a theoretician. And so he just, you know, would sit in his study and work out his equations.
That worked out well.
So we lived in Scotland, and he was a scientist.
Now, I read that you have two sisters, right?
I have two sisters,
and
yes.
I also read that all three of you were scientists.
That's correct.
That's
yes.
crazy. Isn't that crazy?
Are
similar sciences?
Well, my one sister, Alex, is a applied mathematician and underwater acoustician, which is very similar to what my dad does. They basically, they've written papers together, so they're mm-hmm. they're very close scientifically. And I'm close scientifically to what my dad started in. He started in marine geophysics, but he went more into the applied math later in his career. My other sister, Aline, is an astronomer, so sort of the other end, looking up.
Yeah, looking up while you're down. I also read that, I mean, you said you were introduced to science, obviously, at a very young age, but also that you were into the theater.
I was, yes. I love
theater.
So that's
all the way over here.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is sort of all the way over here, but I always argue that I actually think that the arts and creativity is much closer to science than people like
would have thought.
You know,
uh-huh.
it's
and why is that?
I think to do science well, there's a lot of creativity involved. You have to be able to imagine that things aren't, you know, just exactly how that you've always been told. You have to make new discoveries. You have to be willing to think a little differently and think a little creatively.
So here's the thing. You go out on this first expedition. It turns you on, whets your appetite. But I would have to assume way back then, not that you're so old, you were an anomaly on that 10-day boat trip.
You mean I was the only woman?
Well, that's where I was going.
Yes, I was the only woman. Yes.
How was that?
You know, it didn't faze me that much.
Mm-hmm.
I almost want to say I didn't notice so much. I was so busy doing what I was doing, and mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. I do remember on that first cruise, there was a mate who thought that women were bad luck on ships. And that, you know, that's sort of a very old-fashioned view that women used to encounter, that sailors thought women were bad luck, so they shouldn't be on ships.
Meaning what?
Just that, you know, things would go wrong if there were women on ships. That was, I can't
what else
explain what yeah. they were thinking,
okay,
because I don't
not.
Really get it. But this was sort of the mythology that mm-hmm. that women were bad luck on ships. But, you know, he left me alone. He just wasn't very friendly.
Well, he wouldn't want to go near you.
Exactly. But after that, I have to say, you know, the sailors in particular were very supportive of having women on board. And you know, a number of my best friends are sailors. I made really, really good friends out there, and they really, I felt, let me be part of their community. And the sailor community, and particularly on these research ships, can be very tight-knit because they're traveling, you know, all around the world together, and they're out at sea often for 4 or even 6 months at a time.
Sure.
So
you better like each other.
You better like each other. And the ships become these little small communities. And so when you come on as a scientist, you're usually just on for one leg that, you know, maybe a few weeks or a month and a half max, and then you go. And so I always considered it kind of of a privilege if they would let me into their community, and they were very friendly in general. So.
But before you actually started to apply your knowledge, mm-hmm. weren't you also an anomaly in school in terms of classes
and subject matter? In high school, there weren't that many girls that were interested in science. I had a wonderful, wonderful high school teacher up until the age of 16, Mr. Jackson. He was just fabulous, and he made me laugh all the time with science, and there were absolutely no issues with him. He was wonderful. But then my final year of high school, I had to go to a different school because my other school only went up to 16, and there I had a physics teacher who put the girls at a separate bench and basically ignored us, and you know, would go around all the boys' benches asking if they had any questions and just ignore us, and then would scream at us, you know, with the slightest provocation. And then when he discovered that I had applied to Edinburgh to do physics, he yelled at me in front of the whole class and said physics wasn't for girls and I was going to fail in my first year and that mommy wouldn't be there. And he really got furious with me. But, you know, I went.
Do you remember your reaction to it? Did you want to throttle him?
I was very shy mm-hmm. at that age. And I just remember feeling really intimidated. It sort of gave me this tightness across my chest, like because he seemed so out of control, angry. And this teacher was actually known. He'd been thrown out of another school for throwing a chair at a student. So he had some anger management issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found him pretty intimidating.
Did he know what you did subsequent to graduating?
I don't think so. No, but I ran into him in my second year. Not that kind of ran into him, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I ran into him my second year of university when I was on a geology field trip in the town where the school was. And I came up to him and I said, "Hey, Mr. Somerville, it's Maya, you know. I made it through my first year."
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Maya Tolstoy, who is a marine geophysicist. You were on 31 ocean-going expeditions. We only have 30 minutes, but can you describe the challenges then that you faced as a woman in a male-dominated field, you know, bad luck notwithstanding?
You know, for the most part, my challenges haven't actually been at sea. My challenges have been more back on land. I have had a few issues at sea, but relatively minor. I had a very supportive advisor mm-hmm. and at Scripps, John Orkett, and he really let me run things as I got more and more senior. And he mm-hmm. was very busy. He was in D.C. a lot. So after a while, he basically let me take out his cruises and let me lead the operations part. And I really appreciated that experience. And like I said, the sailors were always very supportive. So I had generally a wonderful experience at sea.
But you have experienced sexual harassment.
Oh, absolutely, of course.
So yes. You're saying
it's so common, yeah. For me, it's mostly been on land. I know there was a recent paper that came out this summer that talked about women in the field sciences, about 75% of them, I think, experiencing harassment in the field. And, you know, I've had a little bit of that in the field, but my bigger problems have actually been on land.
And what have those problems been? And they continue today in 2014?
You know, they sort of evolve with age. I think when I was younger, I had a lot more with harassment.
Yeah. And now with this track record of yours, are people respect you more?
Well, it's always a struggle. It's always a struggle. And I think there's lots of wonderful men in the field who mm-hmm. are very supportive. And then there's a lot of, I think, what they just call subconscious bias, where people don't really know what they're doing. And then there's always a few who are just outright nasty.
And it's just your cross to bear? Is that what you're saying?
You know, I guess so. I spend a lot of time thinking about it and worrying about it. And I try not to, because I try to think about how I can make things better, and I try to speak out about things now that I have tenure, that I'm in a secure position. But you also have to be careful not to get bitter about it, and so I
yes, because it could be paralyzing,
right.
Couldn't it?
I try to remind myself how lucky I am, because mm-hmm. I have a very good job and I have a very secure job, and that's not true of a lot of people, both in academia and outside of academia. So I'm really in a pretty lucky situation. But I know a number of women who've left the field completely, either because they had so much trouble getting funded, or because they just couldn't stand the environment, who they really found it too oppressive.
And your work speaks for itself.
But I was always a bit of a fighter. You know, I know even though I was sort of quiet and shy as a child, I always sort of stood my ground and, you know, wasn't easily intimidated. So people might scare me, but and mm-hmm. I would just stand my ground. Mm-hmm.
Tell us how you got involved with James Cameron and describe that expedition, because that sounds pretty cool to me, because science is just make, you know, my eyes glaze over. I was that stereotypical girl who just, in science class, would be looking at the clock, please move.
So that was a lot of fun. It was a friend of mine from grad school who'd been working with Jim on a Mars camera project who recommended me. He was putting together this expedition to go film hydrothermal vents in the mid-ocean ridge environment, and he was looking for scientists to participate. And so a friend of mine had recommended me to him, and I'd initially said, no, I'm not going to go, because I was pregnant at the time that my friend Mike got in touch with me, and I said, I'll have a new baby at that point, and I can't go. But then I got this project funded by the National Science Foundation to put seismometers down on the East Pacific Rise at a particular site that called Nine North that the community has been fascinated
with.
Which
is where?
About 2 days west of Acapulco, 2 days west, steaming west, so it's in the tropics on the eastern equatorial Pacific. And so we got funding to put these seismometers down, and it was a site that the community has been studying for more than a decade. It was a super exciting site, and we all thought it was building toward an eruption. So I really wanted to get those seismometers down as soon as possible. And this cruise, Jim's cruise, gave me the opportunity to deploy them probably a good year earlier than I would have if I'd had to wait for the regular research ship. So I signed on, and it was tremendously hard to leave my baby at home.
That so was how really, old was your
he
son,
was,
right?
He was 4.5 months when I first went out.
And you were going to be gone from him for how long?
I was going to be gone for a month. So that was the first cruise, and then I was home for 3 weeks, and then I was out for another 2 weeks.
With Cameron?
With Cameron. So first we had a cruise in the Atlantic and then a cruise in the Pacific, and they wanted me to go on both of them.
So when it rains, it pours. Forgive the cliche, but it's true.
But that was such an amazing opportunity, because not only did I get to start my science early, and that data actually proved really critical, and the Nature paper that you referenced earlier that the National Science Foundation highlighted was from those data that I collected on that cruise. So we not only got extremely exciting data, but I got to dive in the Russian Mir submersibles, which was an enormous adventure. I mean, that was just fabulous.
So what does that mean in English?
So the Russians operate these two three-person submersibles from this ship, the Keldysh, and that was the ship that Jim was using to do the filming. And he's used that ship for filming the Titanic as well. Because they have two submarines, they can, you know, send one down and use the other to film it so it's more photogenic, obviously. The U.S. operates one academic submersible like this. The Japanese have one, the French have one, but the Russians have two, so it's really cool. And you go down in this, it's almost like a little spacecraft. It really felt like a spacecraft, full of switches and whatnot, and it's very cramped inside. It's about 6 feet in diameter.
And you're with somebody else?
And you're with two other people, so there's three of you down there. And the mirrors also can stay down for a long time. I think my longest dive was about 16 hours.
No bathroom. Nothing to eat.
But it's so amazing, because you basically go down to the bottom of the ocean, which might be a couple miles down, depending on which site you're going to, and you get to see these hydrothermal vent systems.
What's a hydrothermal vent?
So those are...
I got to dumb this down.
Okay. So these are one of the things that I study that are so fascinating. It's kind of like, you know, at Yellowstone, you've got these geysers of gushing hot water. Well, it's a similar thing, but on the seafloor, and they tend to come out. It doesn't gush out in pulses. It comes out fairly steadily. And so it's super hot water that's... percolated down to near the magma chamber of this volcano through the cracks in the rock, and then it gets heated up by that magma. And as it gets heated up and as it interacts with those rocks, it picks up little nutrients and minerals, and then it comes gushing out at these vents, at these pipes basically on the seafloor. And because it's so hot and it has all this stuff dissolved in it, when it hits the cold water, the minerals precipitate out, and you basically get a smoke-like effect. So all the sulfur is one of the big minerals that's black. Mm-hmm. That precipitates out when it hits the cold water, and you get this gushing black chimney of smoke.
And what does that do to the sea life?
Well, so it actually...
That was a good question, right?
That was a great question. That was the perfect lead-in. Thank you. So what it does is it supports these really bizarre chemosynthetic ecosystems. So chemosynthetic means it lives off the chemistry rather than photosynthetic, which lives off sunlight. And so it's creatures living there on the sulfur, basically. So little bacteria eat the sulfur and then other creatures eat the bacteria.
Yeah.
And it's an ecosystem there that scientists didn't think could survive. Nobody thought there was anything down there. When scientists first discovered these black smokers in the 70s, it was a bunch of geologists in a submarine because nobody thought to bring a biologist because nobody thought anything could live down there.
Okay.
And so it's basically expanding the boundaries of how life can exist or of how we understand life can exist. And that's part of why NASA's interested in it. And that was part of the film that James Cameron made was called Aliens of the Deep.
Uh-huh.
And it was comparing these deep seafloor hydrothermal systems with what we might find in space and potentially Europa, which is this ice-covered moon of Jupiter that is thought to have an ocean underneath the ice and may support some hydrothermal vents. We don't know.
So that was kind of a seminal experience for you, wasn't
it? It was an amazing experience. And getting to work with James Cameron was really incredible.
So you'd go down with three other people in this
two
capsule.
Other people.
Three people, and do your research.
Right.
And then come up for air.
Yeah.
Were you the only woman on that?
No, not at all. No. Cameron made sure there were that women scientists were well represented.
So was he the boss?
He was the director. So mm-hmm. yes,
and yeah,
he let us do our science. You know, mm-hmm. he was basically facilitating the science, and so you know he made these facilities available, this ship and this submarine, to a whole group of us to do whatever science we needed to do.
It took what you learned there and brought it back to land.
Right. Exactly.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Now that was 2005.
Yes.
But you've been...
Well, actually, it was 2003 was the cruise. The film came out in 2005.
So in that 11 years, how often have you been back to see?
You know, as wonderful as that experience was, the trauma of being gone from my baby for that long, I basically put a moratorium on going to sea for a number of years. And then I started again briefly in 2008 and then didn't go out again until I think it was 2011. But now I'm limiting my cruises to 2 weeks. I basically won't go out for longer than 2 weeks, even though he's older now. I hate being gone from him. And he's able to articulate that he doesn't want me being gone.
Yes, sure.
So I try not to go as much.
That doesn't negatively impact your work.
No, it's fine. I mean, there are bigger expeditions I could be going on, but I'd honestly rather...
You don't feel cheated.
See my child's
grow up
childhood,
mm-hmm,
and I'll go out again for longer periods of time when he gets older, and maybe I'll even take him with me.
Oh, there's something that would he love to do that?
I think so. I hope so.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Maya Tolstoy, who is a marine geophysicist. So, what is it that you're doing on land now?
Well, a lot of what I'm doing is analyzing data that I collected, including that data that we collected on Cameron's expedition. And
so that kind of has a long lifespan.
It has a long lifespan. I mean, and there's a lot of data now that's coming in that's open to the community. So what's really nice is that the community is starting to move toward what we call community experiments, where there are experiments that are larger than any one individual PI or scientist could get funded. So we do it on a very large scale, and the community gets together and agrees what we're going to do and designs the experiment. And then it's deployed by a group of essentially volunteers. And I am a volunteer on one of those community experiments. But as soon as the data comes back to land, it's made openly available, and anybody can use it. It's just put online. And so there's a lot of data out there to analyze. So I could easily never go to sea again,
mm-hmm,
and have plenty of data to analyze for the rest of my career. But I enjoy going to sea. So I will get back into doing it more regularly.
And obviously you also teach.
I do, yes.
So what have you noticed gender-wise?
There's a lot of women in both the undergraduate and the graduate body in
so you feel
earth sciences.
But that's good
been,
about
that's
that.
Been the case for a long time.
So this is
and
now sort
been,
of ho-hum? We don't even have to bring that up anymore?
Well, no. What's interesting and sort of disturbing about it is that the numbers go down as you go further up the rank, and it's referred to as the leaky pipeline. So the numbers in graduate school at Lamont have been 50-50 for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers in the faculty ranks are not yet 50-50. And so it's...
That's improving. Weird, isn't it?
Well, you know, some of it is just it takes time. But I'm actually in the middle of finishing a pipeline study for arts and sciences across the board at Columbia University as part of that Commission on the Status of Women. And it doesn't change as fast as it should. And so we're trying to identify where those leaks are in the pipeline and why the change isn't faster.
If you have teachers like that jerk you had in Scotland who are not encouraging when women are younger, maybe it's really important to get into the high schools and middle schools.
Yeah, there are programs that do that as well. And I think that's very important, too. But what I focus on is really the academic track, because that's what I know most about. Mm-hmm. I think you really need experts in high school education and K-12 education to know how to implement the work in the high schools. But in academia, we've got our own set of challenges that we have to deal with.
Yeah, I guess that never changes. Yeah. To really switch gears here, I saw that you're a member of SAG and AFTER, which is the Screen Actors Guild, and AFTER is the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, of which those two unions merged, and I'm a member of them also. Why are you a member of SAG and AFTER?
I got in a little bit by a fluke, like we discussed earlier. I was always interested in acting, and I still love it. And
when
I
what
was,
did you do? Put on shows on let's put on a play.
I
out
don't
on
really
the ship.
I don't really do anything in it at the moment. I'm a little too busy with the day job and the child. But when I get an opportunity, I enjoy it. And teaching's a little bit like acting.
I would think so. Absolutely.
I enjoy that. So I was doing a few things on the side in New York before I was a mom, but nothing major. And then through a choir I was in, I actually got Taft-Hartleyed and waved into SAG. And I was so excited about it when I found this out that I just joined SAG I sold the tiny little amount of stock I had and paid the initiation fee and joined SAG. Without actually realizing that you're not going to get any work unless you have an agent. And so once I joined SAG, all the work that I could do was non-union. You know, the stuff I knew about was non-union. So then I actually, it was a bit of a catch-22. But I ended up moving to LA for 3 years, and I got a visiting position at UCLA while I kept my position at Columbia. So I sort of commuted between New York and LA for about 3 years and tried to see whether there was anything I could do in the film world. And I really enjoyed my time in LA and I learned a lot. But then I had a child and it wasn't so practical to commute
I was just thinking, New York.
And I
could you have, you know, auditioned for James Cameron?
I know. Well, it was so funny. It was basically, within months of giving up or a year or so of giving up doing anything in LA that this opportunity for James Cameron came along. In the documentary, we do actually reenact a couple of things in the sub, and so I got to be directed by James Cameron, and that was so cool.
So you can die and go to heaven. Yeah.
I know, but I still sort of fantasize about doing something in the film world. I have a really good friend in LA who's a director, and she works a lot on the issues about how few women directors there are and how underrepresented women
are in
film.
Yes, all too aware of that.
And so I would love to someday make like a small film with her, but I don't actually feel like I need to be the actor in it either. I love sort of every aspect of it. And when I was in LA, I wrote a screenplay with a friend of mine, and we just had a blast doing
that. Where is that now?
It's in my drawer.
You're not ready to.
Well, it's a long and sad story, but we wrote it just for fun, and then I actually met this guy high up in a big agency who asked me to send it to him. I did, and he sent it back. And then I took a screenplay writing class at UCLA called Rewriting Your Screenplay, and I realized how phenomenally bad this script was. Like, we were just so naive about writing it. So we did a lot of changes, made it much better. And my computer was stolen with all the changes, and I didn't have a hard copy, and I didn't have a backup. So now all I have is the hard copy of the old version with lots of scribbled notes
Isn't
on it. So
that
I have to
something?
Go back
and you have so much copious free time to do that.
Exactly.
Oh boy.
But the one thing I wanted to say about the film industry, what was interesting, what I realized later in life, what really draws me to it is the same thing that drew me going to see, and that is the teamwork. The fact that you get involved in this sort of very intense project, mm-hmm. and you have to work together, and it's sort of all consuming, and you're either, you know, with the seagoing work, you're trying to discover something, you're trying to tell the story of what's on the ocean floor, and with a film project, you're trying to tell another story, whatever the film is about. And I just love that sort of camaraderie that develops when you're working together intensely on a project.
Well, you lead me into, I'm going to use your telling a story. Thank you for telling your story. We've run out of time. You really made it so interesting, and you actually made science, well, it's not approachable for me. I'm a little too old, but I found it fascinating, and you're fascinating. And thank you so much for joining me today, Maya.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.